You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's day two of the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, and this morning Senator Bernie Sanders addressed the Wisconsin delegation breakfast. WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson's reporting now from Philadelphia this week, and he joins us with the latest. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
Well, last night, some big-name speakers, Michelle Obama, Senator Elizabeth Warren, and Bernie Sanders. What was it like there in the arena last night, Sean?
It was pretty electric. I mean, these are some fan favorites among Democrats that were all going last night. And on a day which saw and heard some boos by Sanders supporters at the start of the convention, just at the mention of Hillary Clinton, those tapered off a little bit as you got into those big-name speakers toward the end of the night. I mean, Michelle Obama is extremely popular among Democrats. Elizabeth Warren, Senator Warren, is a huge favorite of Bernie Sanders supporters and Democrats at large. And then you heard Bernie Sanders himself, who got a three-plus minute standing ovation. So got pretty noisy in the arena last night, and I think you're probably going to hear that a little bit more later this week.
I understand rules and platform were passed earlier today. Anything notable from that?
So that ended up happening yesterday, and it was not notable, I guess, is what I can tell you. I mean, everything that came out of committee, basically, and these committees for the Democratic National Committee met at length on this stuff, that all is what was passed on the floor. So, you know, there were some Sanders delegates who wanted to move the platform to the left on issues like trade, who wanted to abolish superdelegates. That did not happen. Superdelegates are still going to be a factor in the Democratic Party's nominating process, although they may be scaled back a bit. And the language on trade won't be quite as strong as what Sanders supporters were hoping for.
You've been tracking the Wisconsin delegations both at the Republican convention last week, now at the Democratic convention this week. Bernie Sanders made the rounds at a lot of state conventions this morning, or state delegations this morning. What did he have to say to the Wisconsin delegation over breakfast?
Yeah, at the Wisconsin delegation, he had a pretty friendly crowd. This is a state that Bernie Sanders won, and so he had a majority of Bernie Sanders delegates in the room. So Bernie Sanders basically told the crowd there that they had a few jobs ahead of them to continue what he called their revolution.
Our job is multifold, it seems to me. Number one, obviously in the next few months, we have got to do everything that we can to make sure that Donald Trump, who in my view is the worst, least prepared candidate for president in my lifetime. Number two, we've got to obviously elect Hillary Clinton. Number three, we have got to stay focused on our issues and force every level of government to represent working people.
Sean, applause at that last line there. Not applause on the "we have to elect Hillary Clinton and defeat Donald Trump." How was the speech received by the delegation, which, as you say, had a lot of a majority of Sanders delegates there?
Yeah, I mean, they liked him. I did notice that he slipped through that Hillary Clinton line really quickly, and it was sandwiched between two things that, people in that room couldn't really disagree with. They wanted to defeat Donald Trump, and, they support his goals going forward as far as empowering working people. So, brief mention of "we got to vote for Hillary Clinton," obviously, right there in the center, and then a big applause from the crowd, and Sanders was off to other state delegations.
Talking to WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, reporting from Philadelphia and the Democratic National Convention. That was Senator Sanders. I understand U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin spoke to the delegation this morning. What did she have to say?
She did. Her message was what you're hearing from a lot of Democratic leaders right now, and that is that you really don't want to have Donald Trump be president of the United States, and that if Democrats ever want to enact their agenda, they're going to need control of all branches of government, and that includes the presidency, so they're going to need President Hillary Clinton. She also talked to reporters afterward about the significance of what's going to happen tonight. They're going to have the formal nominating process, and this convention is going to nominate formally Hillary Clinton to be the Democratic Party's candidate for president. Senator Baldwin said, that's big for practical reasons. She'll be able to bring her life experiences to the presidency, but also symbolic reasons.
That symbolic power should never be underestimated. For a young person to see the first African-American president, for a young person to see the first woman senator, for a young person to see the first openly gay member of the House of Representatives or the Senate, all of those can tell a young person, I can do anything. I can aspire to do anything. This is a country where I can be whatever I dream of being if I work really hard and dedicate myself. And that's what I heard Michelle Obama saying. And I think a lot of people will experience that moment this week. And it may even surprise them.
And Sean, Senator Baldwin's Wisconsin colleague in the U.S. Senate, is up for re-election this year. A tight race. Russ Feingold running against Senator Ron Johnson. Has the delegation there in Wisconsin been talking about that, or is all the focus pretty much on the presidential race?
They kind of talked about it in the same breath as we need to support Secretary Clinton. So we need Secretary Clinton and we need Russ Feingold. Actually, Senator John Tester of Montana was there today. And he talked to the Wisconsin delegation as well. So he said he was going to be presumptuous and thank them ahead of time for returning Russ Feingold to the Senate.
Now, we've seen some delegates, Sanders supporters, trying to make a ruckus, some protesting, some boos on the floor during speeches. The Wisconsin delegation, the Wisconsin Sanders supporters, have they had much to say about that, or have they been participating in that?
Yeah, From what I'm told, there are a couple of Wisconsin, at least a couple of Wisconsin Sanders delegates who are participating. I'm not sure to the degree. I mean, you, as a member of the media, you can be on the floor of the convention itself a little while, but not for long. So you don't get to observe all this stuff. But I'm told there are a couple. By and large, the Sanders delegates that I talked to say, even though this isn't the way we want it to turn out, they're going to vote for Hillary Clinton in November. Some of them talk about it in very pragmatic terms, really no glee in their voice, but they say, considering the alternatives in front of me, I'm going to vote for Hillary Clinton. It will be interesting to see how the crowd acts tonight, especially Sanders supporters, when Bill Clinton speaks to the arena. Bill Clinton is an obvious choice for a convention like this for so many reasons. He's a former Democratic president. He's a really great speaker at events like this. And he is, of course, the husband of Hillary Clinton, the presumptive nominee. But Bill Clinton is somebody with whom Sanders supporters have had some issues, especially on trade. I mean, he signed NAFTA. So the reception that he gets tonight is definitely worth watching.
And the roll call event, are people, presumably the outcome is that Hillary Clinton will no longer be the presumptive nominee. She'll be the actual nominee. Are people expecting much drama, maybe protest during that? Or is it expected to be just mostly hoopla and maybe a tone of glee in some voices?
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if there was some level of protest during that. I'm not sure to what degree. I think what you want to watch for tonight is, will Bernie Sanders do what Hillary Clinton did in 2008? When this roll call tonight is it's kind of pomp and circumstance. They could cast all these ballots privately, obviously, but they make a show of it. And as they were making that show in 2008, Hillary Clinton came to the floor and said, let's suspend the balloting and support Barack Obama, to huge cheers from the convention. It could be that Bernie Sanders would do the same thing tonight. We'll see how that's received if he does.
Sean, thanks a lot for keeping us up to date there.
You're welcome, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. He joined us live from Philadelphia for the latest on the Democratic National Convention.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's summer camp season. We'll learn about the history of summer camps here in Wisconsin and then ask for your favorite summer camp memories.
First, Blair Braverman wanted to challenge herself, and she wanted to do it in a place that she's always been drawn to, the North. So she spent years in places like Norway and Alaska to figure out how to trust herself, and along the way to discover her passion for dog sledding.
Today, she's the author of the book on her experiences, Welcome to the GD Ice Cube, Chasing Fear and Finding Home in the Great White North.
Blair Braverman lives and writes in Wisconsin, where she works with her team of sled dogs in the winter. Blair, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you.
Well, I want to know what first drew you to these cold zones of the world, places like Norway and Alaska.
Oh, you know, that's the one question I should have a good answer for by now. But I grew up in the desert in California, and I wasn't quite at home there, and I wanted something that was totally the opposite. I just felt like I was this kid in California who should have been a polar explorer.
And it sounds like that's a big part of why you did this, why you went to these places. And we're not just talking, when we say Norway, I don't mean you were in Oslo. I mean you were in the far northern part of the country and in a tiny little town because you wanted to test yourself there in a way and to learn to trust yourself. So why did you feel like that was the place that would allow that all of that stuff to happen for you?
You know, it was sort of by accident. I knew I wanted to go up north, and I ended up going to a folk school in northern Norway when I was 18, which is a year-long public boarding school where the students learned dog sledding and Arctic survival for a year. Slept outside every night in ice caves and igloos. You know, we'd be out for days or weeks at a time and 30 or 40 below. And I loved it. I felt like I could finally have a kind of faith in myself that's tough to hold on to when you're a teenage girl. And so even when I left, I looked back on that place, you know, even less for the landscape and more for who I had felt like when I was there and, you know, the competence and trust in myself I had developed.
And I want to know more about what that time at that folk school was like, because that's where you got your first introduction to dog sledding. Who was your teacher and what were those first moments like?
Yeah, my teacher was a Sami man named Talik is his name in the book. And, you know, we started out on wheels. That's how the dogs pull you in the fall. And it's terrifying. If you've never been dog sledding before, and I highly recommend it, it is terrifying to start because the dogs are so excited and they're leaping and they're so strong. And it's utterly out of control. And so I got onto this, like, lurching, rattling cart with eight dogs in front of it, and I was sitting and Talik was driving, and it's just like this overwhelming noise and chaos, and the moment they start running, the moment you untie the cart, it's just silent. And you can just see these dogs sort of churning forward and their legs pumping up and down, and they're so happy, and it felt like something I'd been looking for and hadn't known, you know, like this very powerful, visceral love for this activity right away, love for the dogs.
So is it about the movement through the landscape, or is it about more about the dogs and doing something in tandem with this animal that you feel this connection with?
I mean, those go so hand in hand. It's about the dogs. It is, you know, if it wasn't about the dogs, I'd be a cross-country skier or a snowmobiler. But it is the teamwork with the dogs. It's the fact that, you know, their lives are depending on you and your life is depending on them in a very real way. So it's this camaraderie that has a lot at stake and is also really powerful for that reason.
And it sounds like during that time at this folk school in Norway, you were in some pretty extreme situations. I mean, just sleeping outside in an ice cave or an igloo, I think might be extreme enough for some people. But there was a story you tell about how you went out in a storm, you were kicked off some land, and you had to mush overnight through a storm. And it sounds like you weren't even sure you were going to make it through that night. What was that like?
We didn't know where we were going. We were essentially kicked out of Finland. Kicked out of Sweden, and we had to get to Finland in a blizzard overnight. And I was with one other girl, one other student there, and six dogs, and we set out into the blizzard, and we lost track of everybody else. The snow was so thick that we started on a trail, and within an hour, the dogs could hardly walk through it. It was up to their chests, and so we had to take turn walking in this sort of swirling darkness in front of the team of dogs in a direction that we didn't know where we were going. And we thought about camping down, building a snow shelter for the night. But in a situation like that, whether or not this was the right move, there's a lot of comfort in moving forward, even if you don't know where forward is. And we went like that through the night, and as the sun didn't rise up there, but as sort of a light was creeping over the horizon, we ended up at this sort of underground camp, or this round building that was half underground that was a reindeer herding camp. And we were able to tie up the dogs and feed them. It was at least 40 below. We're like, your breath is just, you can't even see through it. And just as we'd gotten the dogs tied down, the reindeer migration passed through, just this sort of sweep of herds as far as you could see, just the landscape turning brown. So that was just one of many moments that has stayed with me the most from that year.
So how did you know where you were going? Did you just trust the dogs? Did the dogs sort of, were they able to sniff their way there, or were you just lucky?
The dogs were going somewhere. You know, now I look back, and I have sled dogs now, and I'm training for the Iditarod, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I would not do that again. I don't endorse the choices I made as an 18-year-old trying to get across the tundra. But at the time, we just trusted the dogs because they knew a lot more than we did. And it worked out. They did know where they were going, as it turned out.
We're talking with Blair Braverman right now. She is the author of the new memoir called Welcome to the GD Ice Cube, Chasing Fear and Finding Home in the Great White North. And she lives and she trains dogs in Mushes and Mountain, Wisconsin. And Blair, that story, it really... I think about that, I think about myself, and I think there's no way that I could ever do that. Can you describe what that sort of experience, what dog sledding, mushing demands of you physically and mentally?
It's physical, but it is much more mental, and it's a kind of endurance that's less, I don't even know the term here, but a sort of endurance of energy, less about physical activity, if that makes sense. You have to be on for so many hours and responsible for all these lives that are with you. And, when you stop, when the dogs are resting, the human doesn't rest. I don't rest when my dogs are resting. As soon as they lie down to sleep and maybe I make some beds out of straw if we're on a long trip, or I cover them in blankets, right away it's my job to start melting snow for water and cooking their food and taking off their booties and massaging anyone who might be stiffening up. And, so in a five-hour break, the dogs will sleep for 5 hours pretty much as soon as they've eaten, and I might get to lie down for 20 minutes. So it's pretty demanding in that sense. You see people cross the finish line after long trips or races, and the dogs look great. They look like they could do it over again, and the human looks like they've aged 20 years.
Wow. Well, you've said that mushing is a male-dominated sport, and when you were beginning, your teachers, like we talked about, your first teacher, Talek, they were men. What was it like being a woman in that arena when you were first starting out?
Yeah, I started out more as a tour guide. And so now that I am more competitive in the sport, I do feel like I'm more a part of a community, and I can see those dynamics. It's one of the only sports where men and women compete together. The only other two that I know of are sailing and equestrian. So it's really interesting in that way. I've mostly learned from men. It's only lately that I've been able to find really great female mentors in the sport, women who I've gotten to know personally, who I look up to so much. But I'm the primary musher at my kennel, and I always try to get girls involved. That's one of my main priorities, because I think it's such a good sport for girls. The girls who work with my dogs are anywhere from, the youngest one is 6 or 7 and up through their teens, and you can just see their body language change just from working with these animals. They have to stand taller. They have to speak in a deeper voice, and even that's something girls are sort of can develop habits of speaking in a high voice and a sort of lilt, and they have to project confidence for the dogs, even if they don't necessarily feel it. And then I think that that confidence follows the body language, and they're relying on themselves. It's good for anyone. I think it's a great sport to grow up in, but it really warms my heart to see girls getting into it.
Does the voice that you're talking to me with right now, is that the same as your mushing voice?
No.
Can I hear your mushing voice? Can you do it on the radio? What
yeah.
would you say?
If we're starting, I would say, ready? All right. And then to slow down, I would say, ooh. And if they're doing something that I don't like, I can often correct them with a very quiet sound, like a uh-uh, just like that. Or I'll growl at them if I need to really give them a message. And actually, I'm embarrassed to growl on the radio because my growl isn't very good, and it's really like one of my priorities is to get better at growling.
You're working on your growl.
I really am. If I'm driving alone for a long period of time, I'll just be growling.
I would love to hear tape of that, but I guess I can't. I want to ask you, we just have a tiny bit of time left, but you're training for the Iditarod. What is your training schedule like, and what are you hoping for? Just about 30 seconds here.
Yeah, I just started training this year, and I've got a couple hundred miles of qualifiers under my belt, and I'll be doing another 500 miles with my dogs this winter. So I'm hoping to be ready by spring 2018. And I actually have puppies now who may pull me across Alaska, which is amazing to think about.
Fabulous. Well, we'll check in with you maybe after the race. Blair, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Blair Braverman. She's the author of Welcome to the Ice Cube, Chasing Fear and Finding Home in the Great White North. She writes and she mushes in Mountain, Wisconsin.
Coming up, we'll talk about the history of summer camps here in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up tonight after 7, it's continuing coverage of the Democratic National Convention with live broadcasts of speeches and analysis from NPR. That's tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, we're in the thick of summer camp season, the time when kids leave home for days, weeks, maybe even a month or two to go learn some new skills, ideally make new friends, and enjoy the wonders of camp. Today, there are a lot of different options for families to choose from. Circus camp, math camp, band, sports, leadership, the list just keeps going on and on.
But the first summer camps were very simple. They were a way for kids who lived in urban areas to spend time in nature. Erica Janik just wrote about the history of summer camps in Wisconsin, and she joins us now to talk about it. Erica Janik is the executive producer of Wisconsin Life. Erica, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, when did summer camps become this sort of normal part of American life that lots of kids either went through or loved?
Well, summer camps really only become kind of common for people in the 20th century. They really began in the 19th century. They were really geared at kind of upper-class boys because as American culture was becoming more urban, more people are moving to cities, there's this fear that people are losing touch with nature, that it's demasculinizing our boys. And so we need to send them out into pure nature so that they can get back in touch with their true selves. So you find that those first camps are really for boys. And then in the late 19th century, there's a lot of charitable groups that are organizing camps for the urban poor. And you don't start seeing really camps that welcome girls until the teens, 20s. A lot of camps, not even into the 40s and 50s.
What was the earliest summer camp here in Wisconsin?
So the earliest camp continuously operating is Phantom Lake. It started in the 1890s. Again, only allowed boys at first and then became co-ed, allowing girls. Probably the most famous, though, is Manitowish, which started in 1919. And that was also a boys' camp until, I think, about 1941. It was definitely during the 1940s that they welcomed girls.
Are either of those camps, are they still operating today then?
They are. Still, I mean, I did not grow up in Wisconsin, but Manitowish is one of the very first camps I ever heard about. And I feel like it's definitely the one that's probably the most famous in the state.
So what were they like back then, especially in the early days of camping?
So there are a lot, I think, like what you might imagine. You know, it's a lot of building fires and doing kind of arts and crafts and doing things out in nature. They weren't really the specialized camps that you see now. I think camps have really become kind of niche things. This was kind of all-encompassing recreational camping. A really interesting camp that organized in Wisconsin was called Joy Camps, and that one actually opened in 1930, and it was for girls, and it had this kind of progressive ideals behind it, and they really taught girls survival skills. They were basically sent out into the woods, and they had to build crude shelters. They had to learn how to pitch tents. They learned how to use hatchets and axes, in addition to things like, you know, lanyards and the usual things we think of as summer camp things. But they thought that, you know, this is what girls really needed to have. So in all of these camps, you find this kind of outdoor kind of camping, the usual things that you think about. It's really only later in the 20th century that you start to find these kind of specializations at camps.
How widespread were these camps in those early days, and say in the 30s and 40s? Were a lot of people sending their kids to camps in Wisconsin?
There were a lot of people sending their kids to camps. I mean, it was definitely something that generally only middle and upper class families could afford, unless they went to kind of a charity or a church camp. And certainly during the Depression, some camp attendance did go down because people really couldn't afford to send their kids to camp. But camps, there was really a boom in camps in the 1890s, and that's really when the audience for camps really started to expand. More people were able to go. More camps are being built. And that also kind of leads in the 20th century to these camps starting to specialize, because there are so many camps. And so how are you going to attract people there? Well, guess what? We have a trapeze. You know, so that really attracts a certain audience. And so that's really when camps start to kind of move away from that kind of general all outdoor recreation, arts and crafts, singing songs, that type of thing, to having very specific programs.
And it seems like a part of the focus is still getting kids used to being away from home, sleeping away from the parents, maybe toughening up a little. Is that kind of part of the narrative here, being tough and surviving?
That definitely is part of the narrative, at least the tough part. In the late 19th century, when these camps are starting to form, because there was this worry that particularly boys were becoming soft because they were living in the city, and they didn't have these kind of outdoor nature experiences that made them kind of, you know, the Teddy Roosevelt rough and ready kind of idea. But there is definitely this idea of kind of independence for children. And I think one of the things that summer camps really did is it really helped cement the idea of childhood as kind of protected time in your life, that it was childhood is this playful time. You know, before, a lot of kids had to work. And, you know, that's still certainly the case. I mean, you find that it's mostly kids that are living in cities and kind of suburban areas that are going to camp, because farm kids have to work. That's what they're doing in the summertime. They're not going to summer camp. But as summer camps become more popular, it becomes more common for kids to go to these camps. There's this idea that there's this kind of period in your life where you could just be a kid. You didn't have to go immediately into the workforce. So it's kind of a moving away from the idea that younger people were just little adults, that there actually was kind of a developmental stage that they were going through.
We're talking to Erica Janik about the history of summer camps in Wisconsin. Erica, it sounds like there's a tension there, and maybe that's still true of camps, I don't know, between we need to toughen up the children of today and get them out in nature and survival. And they need to have fun and be kids, too. Would the same pamphlet to say both of those messages at the same time?
I think they might have. You know, I think that there is this idea that they were giving them experiences that they couldn't necessarily have in their daily lives, and that kids were having an opportunity to learn things that they couldn't learn in school. But there was also that, you know, you're here to have fun. Oh, but can you also build a fire? So I think that tension, you know, has been there for a very long time, and it definitely still continues.
My husband and I wandered through a camp that was it's still in function. It was during the off season, so the buildings were there. They were empty. And it was amazing to me because it seemed kind of like a time capsule. I felt like I'd stepped back 50, 60 years. Are they still summer camps recognizable from what they were before? Because from what I saw, they don't seem like they've changed that much.
Well, I think I certainly haven't been to some of the newer camps, but I think there is this kind of rustic look that kind of is still in vogue, that has been, you know, kind of the summer camp look since the early 20th century. You find in the early 20th century, too, a lot of camps start to adopt pseudo Native American imagery as well. And a lot of camps still continue to do that to this day. So I do think that if you go to a camp today, it'll look like a lot like what you remember, because, you know, it's still this idea that it's this kind of rustic outing, and that you don't need the modern conveniences, that the things that you went, that you needed when you went to camp in the 1940s are the same things that you would need and want if you went to camp today.
I wonder today, you know, you've got a lot of competition for kids' time. It could be sports practice through the summer. It could be the part-time job. It could be screens, whatever. Do you have a sense that there was a heyday of camps and we're past that? Or are they still pretty big, but there's just so much noise out there, it doesn't stand out like it used to?
I think one of the things that's changed with these camps is that there's a lot more day camps. I think there's fewer kids are going to residential camps, is what it's called. If you went away for a couple of nights, went for a week or a month, you know, I think there are fewer children going away to like an 8-week session of camp. But there's still a lot of kids that are going to day camps, that are doing, you know, maybe a couple days away. So I think what's really just changed is that there's just all these different types of camps now, whereas before there was really kind of, you know, you went away for a week, a month, 2 months. I think what's changed is just the diversity of the types of opportunities that are available to families.
And there's nostalgia for camps now too, for adults. I've seen ads for camps for grown-ups.
There absolutely is. There's actually something that I think about often, is that there was a This American Life episode maybe like a decade ago that talked about camp people and not camp people. And I think that there are people that went to camp when they were kids and they just loved it and they want to just reclaim that experience. And so I think that's what's part of the appeal of that adult summer camp.
Or maybe it's the people who didn't go as kids and are wondering what they missed.
Absolutely. One of the things that's interesting that's changed about summer camps is that in the 19th century, the average age of a kid who went to camp was 16. And so it was really like what we would think of as maybe as the counselor age now. But starting in about the 30s and 40s, 15 and 16-year-olds thought they were too old to go to camp. And so that's when camps started instituting counselor in training programs, because they still wanted these teens to be coming to camp. And that's when the camp age kind of went down, too. You find a lot more younger kids going to camp for the first time. And the kind of teenage kids that had been the main camp consumers were now kind of educating and guiding younger children through this process.
We're going to invite our listeners to share their camp stories at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Erica, before we let you go, do you have a memory to share with us, positive or otherwise?
I was not a huge fan of camp, I have to be perfectly honest. I went to camp for 5 summers. I went to Girl Scout camp, so I feel that I gave it like a good try. I kept going back. And actually, my dad kept telling me that I would love it and I would regret not going. And so for many years afterwards, I would say, nope, still don't regret it. Nope, still don't regret it.
Not even now.
I mean, I'm glad I went. I'm glad I had that opportunity, because I know that it's not for me.
All right. Not a camp person then.
Not a camp person.
All right. That was Erica Janik, executive producer of Wisconsin Life. Erica, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Erica joining us there to talk about the history of Wisconsin summer camps.
And we want to hear from you now and your history with summer camp. What are your favorite memories of summer camp? Would you recommend the experience to others? Are you going to send your kids? And did you love summer camp or hate it? Call in now or at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also share your cherished or otherwise memories on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll get to your calls in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we just learned about the history of summer camps in Wisconsin from Wisconsin Life executive producer Erica Janik.
Now we want to hear your favorite memories from summer camp. Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. What camp did you go to when you were younger? What was summer camp like for you? Did you love it or hate it? Would you send your kids? What kind of camp are you looking for yourself or your kids? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Camp is so ingrained in our culture that there's a spoof movie about it, probably more than one actually, but we're talking right now about Wet Hot American Summer. Here's a clip from the spin-off TV show from the episode First Day of Camp.
Try new activities like archery, drama, arts and crafts, water sports, and street dance. Make lasting friendships. Be at one with nature and enjoy all the things our amazing facilities have to offer. We've even got a gourmet chef. The summer of your life is just around the corner.
Well, they're selling it pretty well there now. Let's hear from you at 800-642-1234. Carrie is with us in Appleton. Carrie, hi.
Hello.
Tell us about your camp story.
Well, I have to tell you, my kids have been going to camp up in Lakewood through the YMCA since they were 6 or 7, and now they're 15 and going on 18 years of age. And just as you were just talking about, my daughter just finished her 2-week counselor and training session.
Wow.
And then my son is up there right now doing a leader in training. And my daughter loves it so much, she's going back next week to just volunteer.
What do they like about camp? They're clearly camp people. What do they like so much?
I think they love the leadership capabilities. They like being able to help out. They like freedom from mom and dad, which kind of goes both ways. But they really enjoy, you know, the outdoors. They really they love the archery. They love climbing the, you know, rock climbing walls and the high ropes and being able to get out on the water. They really enjoy it. And in fact, my son went when he was only about 6. And the funny story about that one was he wrote me, no, he never wrote me a letter because it was just a 3-day camp. But when I picked him up, he said, you know, Mom, I really missed you. And I really wanted to run away and come back home, but I knew it would be illegal, he said.
Carrie, thank you so much for sharing your kids' camp experience.
Thanks a lot for that call. And we go next to Travis in Appleton. Hi, Travis.
Hey. Yeah, I went to camp between ages 9 and like 11. It was a YMCA camp. And I have to say that there's something definitely intangible and priceless about the interaction that you have at that age, out of your comfort zone with, you know, kids that you just met from all over the world. This camp people would send their kids to, and I have to say, without a doubt, I'm in my 30s now, and I would say that those few years in my life and those experiences that I had a huge impact on who I became, the character, and just basically how I treat people. It's very, very beneficial thing. I definitely suggest it for anyone thinking about it. I'll be sending my kids there.
Wow, that's really interesting, Travis. And are you still friends with any of those people from those key years in your life?
Unfortunately, no. It was before the internet and all these you know, Facebook and everything. So it was very hard to keep up with those folks.
But your kids are going. Well, Travis, thanks a lot for the story.
We'll go next to Jeff on the line in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I grew up in Superior selling mints door to door, and I went to the YMCA day camp where we would go home every day after camp activities during the day. But when I grew up and had the chance to actually work and earn money to go to camp, I worked for Camp Jack Pine out of Wascott, and I had a whole summer there. It was 3 months of activities and fun working with kids younger than me, and we actually took those boys around Lake Superior in a bus 1 week, and I'm sure they remember that experience.
They did the Superior Circle Tour, the whole thing.
Yeah, we went around in Canada, and we told them some of the history, and I'm a talker, so I told a lot of stories. I even made stuff up. But they were all interested.
All right. Jeff, thank you so much. So a kid at camp, and then he went on to work there. And that sounds like a great circle tour of Lake Superior. We're taking your calls right now. Your summer camp memories, or maybe your present summer camp experience if you've got kids there right now. 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Hearing lots of positive stories so far about camps, which is great. I'm going to share one that's not so positive. Our technical director, Michelle Good, did not love summer camp. She shared, on the first day of camp, I was taking the swim test, nearly drowned because they made me tread water for half an hour. She was bullied by other girls in my cabin, woke up in the middle of the night to find a tick in my belly button, called my parents the next morning sobbing, begging to come home. They made her give it one more try, and then Michelle got beaten up. That's such a sad story. And then you had to sit in the little craft dome for the whole day waiting for your parents to come. Not a happy camp story.
Not a happy camper. Well, you know, you're doing okay now, Michelle.
Yeah.
All right, we'll go back to our callers. We've got Jeannie in Madison. Hi.
Hi there.
What's your story?
Oh, my story is I go to an adult singles camp every year.
and it is wonderful. It is that old-timey camp feeling. We have canoes, and we have kayaks, and we have costume party and all sorts of fun.
So you've been going for 20 years now, you said?
Yes, I have been. It's called Amuse, and you can find it online, A-M-U-U-S-E, and we welcome all adult singles. It's just wonderful. It's primarily Midwesterners, but we do have people that come from Texas and Florida and California.
And did you go to camps as a kid, or is this a new thing for you as a grown-up?
This is a new thing for me.
Interesting.
I grew up as a city kid.
All right.
And so, you know, spiders and snakes were never my friends. And snakes still aren't my friends, but spiders are, and other fauna.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling in, Jeannie. Adult camp. Eric was talking about that. That's a thing now.
It is. Yeah. And Jeannie's trying it out. Are you interested, Rob? You want to try adult summer camp?
No, well, I'll skip the singles one for sure, being non-single.
That might be awkward.
Yeah. Right. I think there'd be a lot of
weird
questions to answer.
Well, thanks a lot, Jeannie, for that call. Let's go next to Neil in Madison. Neil, hi.
Hello.
Well, what is your camp story?
Oh, I went to Camp Tasebo in Michigan, which was actually the summer arm of the Todd Seminary, later the Todd School for Boys. And one of the things that really even sticks with me today is that because of the type of school that it had been, there was a very specific plan for taking these boys all the way down to 6 years old, and by the time you matriculated out at 15 or so, you would be a pretty good leader of people.
Hmm. How did they do that? Well, how did they accomplish that?
Well, one of the ways they accomplished it was you got split different ways. You had the people who were in your cabin or your tent, but then you also had the teams. Once a week or so, you'd have some special day where you'd get sliced into other teams where there'd be one boy of each age there. You know, there was a lot of encouragement for the older boys to teach the younger boys. It was really great.
Lots of leadership opportunities there for Neil.
Yeah.
Let's a second caller there about shaping of character happening at these camps.
Do you hear that a lot? Yeah, from people who are camp people, I think. Taking your camp experiences, your memories of summer camp, we've got Jim on the line in Richland Center. Jim, hi.
Hi. As far as camping goes, from my experience, it seems that the counselors have the greatest life impact, and it's really cool seeing what results in the interpersonal relationships there. Today's camps often are not rustic as portrayed by some of your callers. The different accrediting organizations have really changed camping a lot. American Camping Association is one of them. The Christian Camping Conference Association is another one. I'm most acquainted with that particular organization. And the camping itself has really begun to evolve from that of youth camping more towards family camping, sometimes a three-day experience, sometimes a five-day experience. And it's really exciting seeing families being grown and developed through that type of a situation. And there's a camp that I've been associated with that it is just really awesome the way that the servant attitude of the staff is really, really promoted. And the counselors go through a two-week training process.
That sounds great, Jim. We are all out of time. Thank you so much for sharing that observation about camps. Still time for you to share your summer camp memories over at the Central Time Facebook page. Thanks to everyone who called in.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.